Chapter 2 10 miles to the north, Rudy Gunn walked onto the bridge wing of the gray-hulled Russian research vessel, Vereshchagin, and looked up at the azure sky overhead. Removing a thick pair of horn-rimmed glasses, he carefully cleaned the lenses and then peered upward again. Shaking his head, he walked back onto the bridge and muttered, "Sounds like thunder, but there's hardly a cloud in the sky." A hearty laugh erupted at his words, flowing from a portly man with black hair and matching beard. Dr. Alexander Sargov resembled a circus bear, his large frame softened by a jovial demeanor and warm ebony eyes that twinkled with life. The geophysicist from the Russian Academy of Sciences Limnological Institute enjoyed a good laugh, especially if it was at the expense of his newfound American friends. "You Westerners are very amusing," he chuckled in a heavily accented voice. "Alexander, you'll have to excuse Rudy," answered a warm, deep voice from the opposite side of the bridge. "He's never lived in an earthquake zone." The green, opaline eyes of Dirk Pitt sparkled with mirth as he helped heckle his deputy. The head of the National Underwater and Marine Agency stood up from a bank of video monitors and stretched his 6'3" frame, his palms scraping against the deckhead. Though more than 2 decades of undersea adventures had exacted a toll on his rugged body, he still had a lean and fit form. Just a few more wrinkles around the eyes and a growing tussle of gray at the temples indicated a wavering battle with age. "An earthquake," Gunn speculated. The brainy deputy director of NUMA, an Annapolis graduate and former Navy commander, stared out the bridge in wonder. "I've only been in 1 or 2, but those were felt and not heard. Puny ones just rattle the dishes, but larger quakes can sound like a string of locomotives running by," Pitt said. "There is a great deal of tectonic activity under Lake Baikal," Sargov added. "Earthquakes occur frequently in this region." "Personally, I can do without them," Gunn said sheepishly, retaining his seat by the monitor bank. "I hope they don't disrupt our data collection of the lake's currents." The Vereshchagin was engaged in a joint Russian-American scientific survey of Lake Baikal's uncharted current flows. Not one to stay confined in NUMA's Washington headquarters, Pitt was leading a small team from the government research agency in collaboration with local scientists from the Limnological Institute at Irkutsk. The Russians provided the ship and crew, while the Americans provided high-tech sonobuoys and monitoring equipment, which would be used to paint a 3-dimensional image of the lake and its currents. The great depth of Lake Baikal was known to create unique water circulation patterns that often behaved unpredictably. Tales of swirling vortexes and fishing boats getting pulled underwater by their nets were common stories among the local lakeside communities. Starting at the northern tip of the lake, the scientific team had deployed dozens of tiny sensors, packaged in orange-colored pods that were ballasted to drift at varying depths. Constantly measuring temperature, pressure, and position, the pods relayed the data instantaneously to a series of large underwater transponders that were positioned in fixed locations. Computers on board the Vereshchagin processed the data from the transponders, displaying the results in 3D graphic images. Gunn glanced at a bank of the monitors in front of his seat, then focused on one in particular, which depicted the midsection of the lake. The image resembled a pack of orange marbles floating in a bowl of blue ice cream. Nearly in unison, a vertical string of the orange balls suddenly jumped rapidly toward the top edge of the screen. "Whoa! Either one of our transponders is going tilt or there's a significant disturbance at the bottom of the lake," he blurted. Pitt and Sargov turned and studied the monitor, watching as a flood of orange dots raced toward the surface. "The current is uplifting at a dramatic rate," Sargov said with a raised brow. I find it difficult to believe the earthquake was severe enough to produce that kind of effect. Perhaps not the earthquake itself, Pitt said, but a resulting side effect. A submarine landslide set off by a minor quake might create that sort of uplift. 130 miles north of the Vereshchagin and 2,000 feet beneath the surface, Pitt was exactly right. The rumblings that first echoed across the lake were the shock waves from a strong earthquake, measuring 6.7 on the Richter scale. Though seismologists would later determine that the quake's epicenter was near the lake's northern shore, it created a devastating effect midway down the western flank, near Olkhon Island. A large, dry, barren landmass, Olkhon sat near the center of the lake. Directly off the island's eastern shoreline, the lake floor dropped like an elevator down a steep slope that ran to the deepest part of the lake. Seismic studies had revealed dozens of fault lines running beneath the lake floor, including a cut at Olkhon Island. Had an underwater geologist examined the fault line before and after the quake, he would have measured a movement of less than 3 millimeters. Yet those 3 millimeters was sufficient enough to create what the scientists call a fault rupture with vertical displacement, or an underwater landslide. The unseen effects of the quake sheared off a mountain-sized hunk of alluvial sediments nearly 20 meters thick. The runaway chunk of loose sediments slid down a subterranean ravine like an avalanche, accumulating mass and building momentum as it went. The mountain of rock, silt, and mud fell a half mile, obliterating underwater hills and outcroppings in its path before colliding with the lake bottom at a depth of 1,500 meters. In seconds, 1 million cubic meters of sediment was dumped on the lake floor in a dirty cloud of silt. The muffled rumble of the massive landslide quickly fell away, but the violent energy produced by the slide was just unleashed. The moving sediment displaced a massive wall of water, driving it first to the bottom ahead of the landslide and then squeezing it up toward the surface. The effect was like a cupped hand pushing under the surface of a bathtub. The force from millions of gallons of displaced water had to be redirected somewhere. The submarine landslide had fallen in a southerly direction off Olkhon Island, and that was the direction that the mounting swell of water began to move. To the north of the slide, the lake would remain relatively undisturbed, but to the south, a rolling wave of destructive force was released. At sea, the moving force of water would be labeled a tsunami, but in the confines of a freshwater lake, it was called a seiche wave. An upsurge of water punched the surface in a 10-foot-high rolling wave that drove south along the lake's lower corridor. As the wave pushed into shallower depths, the upswell squeezed higher, increasing the size and speed of the surface wave. To those in its path, it would be a liquid wall of death. On the bridge of the Vereshchagin, Pitt and Gunn tracked the development of the killer wave with growing alarm. An enlarged three-dimensional map of the lake south of Olkhon Island showed a swirl of orange dots jumping in rapid succession across an expanding line. "Dial up the surface pods only, Rudy. Let's find out exactly what's going on up top," Pitt requested. Gunn typed a short command into the computer, and a two-dimensional image suddenly appeared on the monitor, showing an array of surface pods bobbing over a 5-mile stretch of the lake. All eyes on the bridge focused on the screen as one orange pod after another visibly jumped in a slow line of progression from north to south. "It's a rolling wave, all right. The sensors are getting kicked up almost 5 meters as it passes," Gunn reported. He double-checked his measurements, then nodded silently to Pitt and Sarogov with a grim look on his face. "Of course, a landslide would produce such a wave," Sarogov said, comprehending the electronic images. The Russian pointed to a map of the lake pinned to the bulkhead. The wave will pass through the shallow delta of the Salenga River as it moves south. Perhaps that will dilute its force. Pitt shook his head. As the wave moves into shallower water, it will likely have the opposite effect and increase its surface force, he said. How fast is she moving, Rudy? Gunn toggled the computer mouse and drew a line between two pods, measuring their distance apart. Based on the spikes in the sensors, the wave looks to be traveling about 125 miles per hour. Which will put it upon us in about 50 minutes, Pitt calculated. His mind was already racing in overdrive. The Vereshchagin was a stout and stable vessel, he knew, and stood a good chance of steaming through the wave with minimal damage. The greater harm would be to the lake's prevailing marine traffic, small fishing boats and transport vessels not designed to withstand the onslaught of a 10-foot wave. Then there were the shoreline inhabitants, who would be subject to an unexpected flooding of the low-lying areas around the lake. Dr. Sargov, I suggest you have the captain issue an immediate emergency warning to all vessels on the lake. By the time anyone catches sight of the wave, it will be too late to get out of its way. We'll need to contact the authorities on shore to evacuate all residents at risk to flooding. There's no time to lose. Sargov beat a path to the ship's radio and issued the warning himself. The radio hummed with chatter as a myriad of respondents called back to confirm the emergency. Though Pitt didn't speak Russian, he could tell by the tone of skepticism in the replying voices that at least some thought Sargov was either drunk or crazy. Pitt could only smile when the normally jovial scientist turned red and spat a series of obvious obscenities into the microphone.
Idiot fisherman! They're calling me a fool, he cursed.
The warnings took heed when a fishing boat in the protected cove of Aya Bay barely survived capsizing as the fringe of the wave passed by and its captain hysterically reported the event. Pitt scanned the horizon with a pair of binoculars and could make out a half dozen black fishing boats motoring toward the safety of Listvianka, in addition to a small freighter and a hydrofoil ferry. I guess you got their attention, Alex, Pitt said.
Yes, Sargov replied with some relief. The Listvianka Police Department has issued alerts to all stations around the lake and is going door to door to evacuate risky areas. We've done all we can do.
Perhaps you would be kind enough to have the captain apply full speed and move us toward Listvianka and the western shore of the lake as quickly as possible, Pitt said, smiling that Sargov had neglected their own plight. As the Vereshchagin turned toward Listvianka and increased speed, Gunn eyed the map of Lake Baikal, rubbing his finger across the lower toe of the lake, which angled to the west.
If the wave holds its southerly track, we should be positioned away from its primary force, he remarked.
That's what I'm banking on, Pitt replied.
We are 18 miles from Listvianka, Sargov said, peering out the bridge window toward the western shoreline.
We will be cutting it close, as you say.
At Listvianka, an old air raid alarm was sounded as the panic-stricken residents pulled ashore their small boats, while larger vessels were secured tightly to the docks. School children were sent home with warnings for their parents, while dockside shops were swiftly closed. En masse, the residents around the lake moved to high ground and waited for the mountain of water to wash through.
It resembles the Irish Derby out here, Sargov said, peering out the bridge window with a humorless grin.
Nearly a dozen vessels dotted the horizon ahead of them, driving toward Listvianka at top speed as if pulled by a magnet. The Vereshchagin's captain, a quiet and steady man named Ian Karatanov, gripped the ship's wheel tightly, silently urging his vessel to sail faster. Like the others on the bridge, he periodically took sneak peeks toward the northern section of the lake, looking for signs of the impending wave. Pitt studied the ship's radar, noting a stationary object lying 10 miles to the southeast of their position.
Apparently, someone still didn't get the word, he said to Sargov, motioning toward the radar target.
The fool probably has his radio turned off, Sargov muttered as he trained a pair of binoculars out the portside window.
In the distance, he could just make out a faint black speck moving slowly across the lake to the east.
Heading right for the middle of the tempest, Sargov said, grabbing the radio microphone again.
Hailing the lone vessel several times brought only silence.
Their ignorance will mean their death, he said slowly, shaking his head as he hung up the microphone.
His anguish was broken by the approach of a loud thumping noise that rattled the windows of the bridge. Skimming low above the water, a small helicopter swooped directly toward the Vereshchagin's bridge before suddenly pulling up and hovering off the starboard wing. It was a Kamov Ka-26, an old Soviet civilian helicopter that saw its heyday in the 1960s as a utilitarian light transport craft. The chopper sported a faded coat of silver paint garnished with a seal from the Limnological Institute plastered prominently on the fuselage. The 35-year-old helicopter dipped closer to the boat as its cigar-chomping pilot tossed a genial wave toward the men on the bridge.
Have released all of the survey pods. Permission to park this whirlybird and get her tied down before the surf's up, crackled the deep voice of Al Giordino over the radio.
Sargov stood and stared out the bridge, looking aghast at the movements of the adjacent helicopter.
That is a valuable asset of the Institute, he said hoarsely to Pitt.
Don't worry, Alexander, Pitt said, suppressing a grin.
Al could fly a 747 through a donut hole.
It might be best if he parked that thing on shore rather than risk getting it tossed off the deck, Gunn said.
Yes. Of course, Sargov stammered, just wishing the helicopter would move away from the bridge.
If it's all the same to you, I'd like to fly by that wayward fishing boat first and try and alert them, Pitt said.
Sargov looked into the markedly calm eyes of Pitt and then nodded in agreement. Pitt quickly reached for the radio microphone.
Al, what's your fuel status? He asked.
Just fueled up ashore at the Port Baikal airfield. Should have about 3.5 hours of remaining flight time if I keep off the gas. But this pilot's seat wasn't exactly manufactured by Lazy Boy, I feel compelled to mention.
After the better part of the afternoon deploying survey pods across the lake, Giordino was weary from flying the physically demanding craft.
Go ahead and set her down on the pad, but keep her wound up. We've got an emergency call to make.
Roger, the radio squawked. The helicopter immediately rose and slipped to the rear of the ship, where it gently set down on a rickety platform built above the stern deck.
Rudy, keep us advised over the radio as to the wave's progress. We'll take the chopper to shore after we head off the fishing boat, Pitt directed.
Aye, aye, Gunn responded as Pitt dashed out of the bridge.
Sprinting to the rear of the ship, Pitt ducked down a level to his cabin, emerging seconds later with a red duffel bag flung over his shoulder. Shooting up a stairwell and down the center passageway, he exited onto the open stern deck, where he edged past a bulbous white decompression chamber. The helicopter thumped loudly above him, and he felt a blast of air from its rotors as he climbed a narrow flight of steps onto the helipad and ducked toward the Kamov's passenger door. The odd little helicopter reminded Pitt of a dragonfly. At first glance, the 30-foot-long helicopter was little more than a high-framed fuselage. The small cockpit appeared to have been sheared in half behind the twin flight controls, the result of a detachable passenger cabin that had been removed. The vintage helicopter had been designed with versatility in mind, and the dead space could be fitted with a tank for agricultural spraying, an ambulance or passenger cabin, or, in the case of the Institute's craft, an open cargo platform. A large rack of tubes was fastened to the platform, which had housed the marine current survey pods.
Above the rack and mounted high on the fuselage was a pair of radial piston engines, which drove the helicopter's two separate contra-rotating blades, one fixed above the other. A spindly forked tail led to a large stabilizer and elevator flaps, but no tail rotor. The KA-26, or Hoodlum as it was known in the West, was built as a practical multi-use lifting system. Put to marine use, it was perfect for operating off small shipborne platforms. As Pitt sprinted to the right side of the cockpit, the passenger door popped open and a young Russian technician wearing a ZZ Top baseball cap jumped to the deck. Nodding at Pitt to take his seat, he handed the tall American his radio headset, then quickly scrambled off the platform. Pitt wedged his duffel bag into the footwell and climbed in, glancing toward his old friend in the pilot seat as he slammed the door shut. Albert Giordino hardly cut the figure of a suave aviator. The stocky Italian with jackhammer arms stood nearly a foot shorter than Pitt. A shock of unruly black hair curled around his head, while an ever-present cigar protruded from a hard face that hadn't seen a razor in days. His mahogany brown eyes glistened with intelligence and a hint of the sardonic wit that sparkled at even the most trying of times. Pitt's lifelong friend and the director of underwater technology for NUMA was more at home piloting a submersible, but had acquired a silken touch with most types of flying aircraft as well.
"I heard the distress warning. You want to go track that roller as it pounds Listvianka?"
Giordino asked through his headset.
"We've got a social call to make first. Get us airborne and head southeast, and I'll fill you in."
Giordino quickly lifted the Kamov off the moving ship and climbed to an altitude of 200 feet, swinging east across the lake. As the helicopter accelerated to 85 miles per hour, Pitt provided a description of the Seiche Wave and the unsuspecting fishing boat. The black hull of the boat soon appeared on the horizon, and Giordino adjusted his direction toward the vessel as Pitt radioed back to the Vereshchagin.
"Rudy, how's our wave rolling?"
"Gaining more power by the minute, Dirk," Gunn's voice replied soberly. "The wave is now topping 30 feet in height at its center, with velocity on the increase as it squeezes past the Selenga River Delta."
"How much time before she reaches us?"
Gunn paused as he keyed in a command on the computer.
"ETA to the Vereshchagin is approximately 37 minutes. We'll be shy of Listvianka by about 5 miles.
"Thanks, Rudy. Keep the hatches battened down. We'll be overhead for the show once we get the fishing boat alerted."
"Roger," Gunn replied, suddenly wishing he could trade seats with Pitt.
The wave was still 40 miles away, and the hills of Listvianka were now plainly visible to the men on the Vereshchagin. The ship would safely be out of the main force of the wave when the tempest arrived, but there was no protecting the shoreline. Counting the minutes to go, Gunn peered out the bridge window and silently wondered what the picturesque lakeside community would look like in another hour.